From TN Headquarters, this is The Jungle Cast.
This week, there was the filing deadline for the quarter, and presidential campaigns filed their financial statements with the Federal Election Commission. Reporters and the public got their most comprehensive look yet at the campaign's spending and fundraising. So, let's take a look at the state of the money race. Topping all Democrats and Republicans, the Clinton campaign raised $47.5 million. In second place was another Democrat, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. His campaign raised $15.2 million, and that is noteworthy because he does not have a super PAC supporting him. Sanders is against super PACs on principle and has pledged to fight Citizens United. However, Sanders has been able to tap into the progressive activist pool of the Democratic Party. That support has allowed him to tighten the race against Clinton and raise these large amounts of money. It's the same donor pool you would see with in other races such as Elizabeth Warren's Senate race from a few years ago. A lot of energized activists who are willing to give money, and a lot of his donations come in small dollar donations, as they're termed. Then the next two were Republicans. So Jeb Bush, former governor of Florida, raised $11.4 million, and then in fourth place was Senator Ted Cruz, raising $10 million. Now, Bush's network of super PACs have also done quite well for themselves, raising over $100 million. However, this is largely thanks to quirks in the campaign finance law. Bush was able to exploit those and effectively raise money for his own super PAC before he announced a candidacy. Before he announced his candidacy, Bush was legally a private individual with all the rights associated with that. Just like any other person, he was able to raise money for super PACs or do what he wished to do because he was a private individual and not running for anything, as opposed to, for example, Senators Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who, as federal office holders, are legally always running for office. So then they would not be able to step in with those super PACs as much. But Bush, as a private citizen, was able to raise money for a super PAC that later would go on to support his presidential campaign. So after he raised, as we can see, boatloads of money for his super PAC, the Right to Rise PAC, Bush finally announced his presidential run. While he had been effectively running for president, legally, or traveling the country, talking about it, being polled as a presidential candidate, legally he was not a presidential candidate. Now, that is an important distinction. And of course, then it gets into the nuances of campaign law, especially campaign finance law, where there are times where he would say, if I run, if he was always careful to say, if I run, and had to make sure he never accidentally said he was even testing the waters, because the words testing the waters are actually a legal term. And when you say those words, then in the view or the eyes of the FEC, you are becoming a candidate or you're looking at a presidential run, and more qualifications are put on, or more kind of criteria and limits are put on what you can do with campaign finance and fundraising. So that, like I said, he was able to kind of exploit that and raise a large amount of money for both his super PAC network and also his presidential campaign with the third highest amount. And Senator Cruz's haul was higher than expected. Now, he has also been in the race the longest, but he has started to go down in the polls, and he is largely, in most polls, in the top 10, but he hovers right around 10th place. And, of course, the top 10 are very important because coming up in August, Fox News has their poll, and they are allowing the top 10 places nationwide. So, just looking at the top 10, Cruz doing much better than expected, and the campaign was quick to actually put that out there. They sent a supportive email to, or they sent an email to supporters talking about how they brought in a pretty impressive haul. So they called it in a sub with the subject line of the story of the year. They claimed that Cruz brought in more money than any other hard dollars, and they linked to a Bloomberg. But regardless, the Cruz campaign very proud of what they were able to raise. And fourth place, that they were over $10 million, or they had $10 million. So that will obviously be very good for them. Now, three candidates actually raised less than $1 million. Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, former Governor George Pataki, and former Senator Rick Santorum, Pataki of New York, Santorum of Pennsylvania. All three are actually hovering right around the bottom of Republican nomination point, with Pataki sometimes not registering at all. Sometimes he's just a little asterisk because no one has less than 1%. However, running a cash-strapped campaign is not new for Santorum, at least. His campaign was also relatively bare-bones in 2012 as well, although he went on to win the Iowa caucus and place second in the Republican nomination. This time around, despite placing second, as we said, not translating into much results for him this time around, currently hovering right around the bottom, along with Jindal and Pataki. Probably, or nationwide polling right now would indicate that he does not get into the Fox News debate. Of course, there's still roughly about a month, so anything could happen. But right around now, he would not be involved. But last campaign cycle, it was familiar territory to be right around the bottom, and a month or two before the Iowa caucus, he started to rise, because in 2012 and again in 2016, he's run a campaign largely focused on the Iowa caucus and just kind of focusing on that, going around to all the different counties, getting his name known. Of course, he has a little bit of an easier job this time, having already run a race and winning the Iowa caucus. But as we see with polling, his work is cut out for him, losing to many candidates. And currently with the Iowa caucus, Scott Walker is leading. Scott Walker just came into the race on Monday. He did not have to file the campaign reports, as Senator or Governor Christie also did not file campaign finance reports, having come into the race so soon. They did not have to file for this quarter. Okay, now there were some actually interesting parts in the reports, because they detail all the costs and all the different fundraising. You can see exactly who they paid, how much, and how much they got from different people. And like we said, how much the Sanders campaign, Bernie Sanders, paid over $400 to both Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield. Now, their first names may sound familiar because they are the Ben and Jerry of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream. And he paid both of them over $400 for ice cream. Now, both Cohen and Greenfield are supporters of the campaign. Now, the Carly Fiorina campaign spent about $186 to the NHL for office supplies. Yes, the NHL. It said the NHL, and of course, most people would think of that as the National Hockey League. We reached out to the Fiorina campaign trying to clarify if it was A, the National Hockey League, and B, why they paid the National Hockey League for office supplies. But there was no response to our numerous requests. Finally, the Clinton campaign, well, they about balanced out when it came out to Larry Flint, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine. He donated $5,400, the maximum, because he gave $2,700 to the primary and $2,700 to the general election fund. Clinton campaign turned around and wrote him a check for the total of $5,400, refunding basically his entire campaign check, not wanting to have the money from him. Continuing on now with the 2016 elections, all five Democratic candidates will be or were in the same spot in Iowa on Friday. Since this podcast is coming out the same day, Friday, we'll just use the past tense just for clarity and consistency. Democratic Party held its first cattle call of the 2016 cycle, and all five candidates were at the event, which is also the Iowa Democratic Hall of Fame celebration. The candidates spoke in alphabetical order, so as Lincoln Chafee, Hillary Clinton, Martin O'Malley, Bernie Sanders, and Jim Webb. This is the first time all five will be together, and also one of the first times that Clinton has to acknowledge her Democratic opponents. Despite the campaign trying to not act like she's the nominee waiting, or trying to not act like this is just a process that they had to just kind of go through in order to become the nominee, Clinton has largely focused her attention on her Republican rivals. She has not mentioned her opponents, especially Senator Bernie Sanders, who's rose up, as we previously said, in the polls and has given her a little bit of a race now. She has not mentioned him by name, but this is one of the first times where she'll have to acknowledge the other Democrats in the race. She has largely focused her attention on the Republican rivals and has called several of them out by name. The other candidates will remain in the room as each one speaks, so they'll all be listening to each other. At the time of our current recording, Lincoln Chafee had already spoken. He spoke for 6 minutes. Each candidate was actually allotted 15 minutes to speak, Chaffee took 6, and he went through, talked about how he supported various topics. He also praised the Iran nuclear deal and President Obama's foreign policy, gave a brief, kind of touched on different elements, again returning to the theme of peace. That has been a large element of his campaign platform. When he announced his presidential run, much of the media attention was actually focused on his proposal to implement the metric system into the United States. And his reasoning with that was actually, again, with peace, saying where his reasoning was, we led the world into the Iraq war, so let's now move to the metric system, kind of as like an apology, or sorry for bringing you into this, we'll move to your system now. But the Lincoln-Chaffee campaign has largely been focused on foreign policy, and of that foreign policy, promoting peace. So like we said, him speaking out favorably of the Iranian nuclear deal. We still have to see how other presidential candidates on the Republican side, more hesitant as we can expect, still looking. And hesitancy is the common theme in Congress, looking at both Democrats and Republicans, trying to look at the deal, figure it out. But Lincoln Chaffee taking a very strong stance in support of it. When we were going on, Secretary Clinton was just starting. She brought up her mother, which is a common element of her campaign this time around, bringing up her mother and also bringing up her role as a grandmother. So like we said, brought up her mother, talked about her childhood. And both candidates did praise President Obama in one element or the other. And we can only bring up Clinton and Chaffee because those are the only two had spoken at the time of our recording right now. Now, for this event, we can effectively group the candidates into 3 groups. First of all, you have the front runner, which is Secretary Clinton, and she just needs to maintain that status. She has the highest expectations going into this event, and she'll largely just be, well, every word she says will be closely monitored, because she has not done many large public events, so anytime she speaks, that's carefully watched. As front runner, that brings the higher bar to match, so a lot of attention on her just as a front runner. But of course, a good deal of attention will be paid to Martin O'Malley, former governor from Maryland, and Bernie Sanders. Well, especially Bernie Sanders, because they are the 2 most prominent anti-Clinton candidates. Former Governor O'Malley has spent the last few years trying to remind America, A, who he is, and B, that he's looking at running for president. However, he has failed to, so far, catch on with the rest of the nation, still remaining in the low single digits, as Bernie Sanders has surged in several states and nationwide. Senator Bernie Sanders has effectively coalesced or brought together most of the anti-Clinton vote. So that's made him very competitive, while leaving everyone else, including O'Malley, kind of in the background. But O'Malley is one of the most prominent anti-Clinton candidates, and so he's with that group with Sanders. Sanders has surged in the state of Iowa. He's starting to become more and more competitive with Clinton. And O'Malley has focused, has focused a great deal of his time in the state for the campaign. So this provides a setting where the two of them can directly paint a contrast between themselves and Clinton. Because right there, they have an opportunity to, with the attention on both them and Clinton, Clinton will go out and, in this case, with O'Malley and Sanders, she will speak before both of them, so if they want to, they can twist and change their speech as needed or if they want to, based off what she says. But after she speaks, both of them will get an opportunity to speak, and they can really paint a contrast between them and selves and Secretary Clinton. Of course, if Secretary Clinton were to do that, some would say as punching down, just given how, even though Senator Sanders has risen in the polls, she still has a very large lead. So, and then finally you have the last group, which would be former Senator Jim Webb and Lincoln Chaffee. These two are seen as long shot candidates who have struggled to register in the polls. This will be one of the largest platforms for those two so far in the campaign. So when it comes to where they can go, it arguably some would say it can only be a positive for them, because it will be a large national audience with the attention on this. So it could only help them with name recognition and getting their ideas out there. But of course, the focus will really be on O'Malley, Sanders, and Clinton, just for those three saying how they react to each other, if Clinton responds to the other Democrat candidates at all, how, and if O'Malley and Sanders take any shots at her, and how they can kind of attempt to bring her down and pull themselves up. Now, moving on from the 2016 news, the International Monetary Fund released a report on the global ramifications of low gas prices. We talked to one of the co-authors, Asim Hussain, about the findings and the global market with low gas prices. We talked to him, so let's take a listen to that now. So, for people who have not read the full report, briefly say what you have found.
Okay, so this is a report that looks at what the global economic impact of the very large drop in oil prices that we've had since the middle of last year, what the global economic impact might be. And the overall finding in the report is that it has a positive economic impact, but that the impact depends on a number of things. And those things collectively suggest that the impact might come more slowly than might not be quite as large as we might have thought initially. So what are those things? Well, first, what the economic impact of the oil price decline depends on is how persistent that decline in prices is going to be. So how long will prices stay low is one thing. Another thing the economic impact depends on is the nature of the oil price drop, whether it is due to greater supply or weaker demand. So if it's due to greater supply, such as because of the discovery of shale oil or the discovery of new technologies, which makes extracting oil cheaper, then that's good for the global economy, and it boosts economic output. If, on the other hand, it's due to just weak demand, that reflects a weak global economy and therefore is less good for economic output. So or economic impact. Another aspect that matters in determining the economic impact is the degree of pass-through. And by pass-through, what we mean in this report is that how much of the decline in international crude oil prices does the consumer actually see? So how much do gasoline prices, do heating oil prices decline in response? Is it half the decline in crude oil prices? Is it three-quarters of the decline, or is it, and so on? And then lastly, an aspect that also determines economic impact is where consumers and firms are to start with when the oil price decline actually happens. And by that I mean, to what extent have people been overextended in terms of their indebtedness? If you have racked up debt on your credit card and on your mortgage, when faced with lower oil prices, you have the opportunity to perhaps work off some of that debt, pay down some of that debt. So you might not actually end up spending that extra money you have from as a result of lower oil prices. Instead, you may end up saving it, at least initially. So that would impact the overall, or that would affect the overall economic impact of the oil price decline. So those are the four areas we've looked at. And so the bottom line is that the oil price decline is persistent. Oil prices will or are expected to stay lower than where they had been in the early part of last year for a long, long time. Second, that the nature of this oil price decline is a little bit of both, but by the supply aspect is the dominant one, or it accounts for more than half. So that will also be good for global growth. The pass-through of crude oil price decline to the retail level has been varied across the world. Some countries have passed through a lot of it, almost entirely. Others have passed through very little. On average, globally, about half of the price decline in oil has been seen by the consumer. So that will help, but it will not help as much as would have been the case if all of it had been passed through. And the reason for this is that in many countries, oil prices are regulated, if not actually even fixed. So in those countries, the decline in oil prices has been very little, if not, and in some, none at all. And then lastly, In many countries, consumers and firms are still working off the high debt they had built up ahead of the global financial crisis. The lower oil prices are helping them to work off those high debts faster. So the recovery will still come, or economic activity will still be boosted, but that might happen a little bit later than right away. But all told, we expect that the global growth will be lifted by about 0.5 percentage point due to the oil price drop.
All right. So you said that this was not as large as we were expecting. This was then a projection error that it was not as large?
Yeah, I don't think it was so much a projection error because we didn't project, you know, how much will be the increase in global growth because of the oil price drop. It was just that because of the oil price drop, we thought that global growth might start to pick up. But that hasn't really happened. Global growth has moved somewhat sideways. And in fact, the growth outlook has actually occasionally been marked down even during the past year. And the reason for that is, of course, that there have been offsetting shocks. Other shocks that were not expected that happened between, the early part of last year and now. For example, in the second half of 2014, economic indicators coming in from many parts of the world, Europe, many emerging markets came in weaker than expected for other reasons unrelated to oil prices. So those have been offsetting.
So you said that we were looking at having these low prices for a long, long time, as you said. Is there a point where these low prices become unsustainable and just how low they are?
I don't think sustainability is an issue. I think what matters is, what's interesting to think about is why we think oil prices might stay low. And for that, I think the reasoning is that the supply gains that we've had are permanent supply gains. It is due to new technologies, and you don't lose those new technologies. Those are there to stay. We've also, if you look at futures markets, markets are also expecting that 5 years out, prices will be higher than they are today, but not by a lot, and certainly not back to the levels they were a year ago. So that suggests also that the oil price decline is likely to persist. Now, interestingly, though, there is a lot of uncertainty. So even though we expect oil prices will stay relatively low for quite a while, you can't be sure about such things. And one example that I'd like to give you, a year ago, when we published our economic outlook in April of 2014, we thought that the range of possible outcomes for the oil price a year forward was something like between $70 and $140 a barrel. Now, a year later, we're already below that range that we had forecast then. So this came as a big surprise. A year ago, no one would have thought that we'd be at $50 a barrel.
All right. So at the end of the report, there are a few different charts, and the one showed that by percentage, three of the largest declines for gas prices have come in the 2000s, or since 2000. Is that a coincidence, or is there something to that where we see so many declines come in the last 15 years?
So I think there have been three, maybe four really large declines. One was in the mid-1980s. Another one was in 97, 98. Then there was one in 2008-09 with the global financial crisis, and then now one in 2014. I don't think it's entirely coincidence, but this has a bit to do with the global economic cycle to the extent that demand factors pulled down oil prices. That was certainly the case in 1998. It was again the case in 2008. In both cases, there were large parts of the global economy did have serious declines. In 1998, it was emerging markets. In 2008, it was advanced economies. In 1980s and the one now, I think supply has been much more of an issue. In the 1980s, OPEC had been cutting back supply in the run-up to the sharp decline in 86. And finally, in 86, they were at a point where they were just actually supplying so little that they gave up and they said, look, we will start producing whatever we're capable of. And as a result, supply increased dramatically, and it stayed high for a long period, and that's why oil prices fell a lot and stayed low. This time around, it's again due to supply has played a major role, perhaps not as much as in the mid-80s, but it has played a large role, and that's the reason to think oil prices will stay low. I don't think it causes a sustainability issue for the global economy. I think it may mean a sustainability issue for certain oil-producing countries that don't have adequate buffers and are unable to adjust their macroeconomic policies in response to the shock.
So, since you just brought up the exporters, there are countries that are overly dependent or very dependent on exporting, like Venezuela or Russia are two examples. But is it possible that these low prices will have, or will they have, great costs to the countries then that depend on exports? What will it look like for them?
Yeah, no, so the large oil exporters, especially those that are heavily dependent on oil exports, not only for their export revenue, but also importantly for their government revenue, they will clearly be affected by the very large oil price decline. Now, among those large oil exporters, though, I would put them into two groups, those that have accumulated pretty substantial buffers and those that have not. So the ones that have accumulated substantial buffers have time to adjust. So all oil exporters will need to adjust their spending in response to the reality of lower revenues. But the ones that have large buffers will have time to make those adjustments. They can do it gradually. The ones that don't have large buffers will need to do it faster, and for them it will be more painful. And by adjusting down spending, that will put a brake on economic activity in their own country, as spending is.
So there would be some negative economic impact?
Yes, lower spending will translate into lower economic growth for them.
All right. And then just as we're looking globally, we are starting to see an economic recovery. How much do lower gas prices contribute to that? Are they a significant part of that global recovery?
Yeah, so, the calculation we had is about a half a percentage point of global growth right now. It's probably due to lower oil prices. So I say that calculation is an indirect one. What we calculate is how much does the decline in oil prices translate into global growth increase, and we find that it's about a half a percent. Now, in fact, global growth has not increased relative to last year by half a percent, but that's because other factors have pulled it down a little, but the lower oil prices have pushed it back up. So my short answer to your question is about a half a percentage point of total global growth this year is thanks to the lower oil prices.
All right. Then just final question as we're wrapping up. In the report it showed a chart with the commodity prices for metal, food, and crude oil, and it showed that the three of them tend to kind of move together. But right now we're seeing crude oil take a sharp decline, especially compared to food and metal. Is there a reason for that? Is there the correlation, or is that just, again, a coincidence?
So they do tend to move together because they all respond to global economic demand, right? As when global economic demand and global activity is running high, then people are consuming more of everything, including more food, including more metals, including more oil. And similarly, when global economic activity tanks, demand for all of those things drops. So oftentimes, in fact, this is one of the ways we assess how much of the drop in 2014, the oil price drop in 2014, may have been due to demand factors. So we, in fact, look precisely at metals prices. And to the extent that metals prices also fell in 2014, it made us think that, the drop in oil prices might also partly be due to demand. But the fact is, metals prices fell by much less than did the price of oil. And so that's what makes us think that it wasn't mainly due to weaker demand, but actually other factors such as supply.
Okay. Well, I'd like to thank you for taking time to talk to us today. The report was quite interesting, and I urge all of our listeners to go out and read it about the ramifications of lower gas prices. Thank you, Asim. Asim.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Asim for talking to us. The report looking at the global ramifications of low gas prices, it's a fascinating piece, really well researched, has some interesting analysis of what it means for exporter countries, importer countries, everyone in between. Great piece, as I said. We'll have a link to it on our show page or our episode page for this week, so that way you can check it out there, read it. Highly recommend it. Now we're going to move on now to some 2016 news, but also that's with the media, because of course here at the Junglecast, we're always looking at the Fourth Estate. Huffington Post made an announcement Friday in relation to their presidential election coverage, or how they're going to cover. In a note from Ryan Grimm, who's the Washington bureau chief for the Huffington Post, and Danny Shea, who's the editorial director for the Huffington Post, they announced that they would no longer be covering Donald Trump's presidential campaign under the politics vertical. Instead, it will be covered under entertainment. They published a short little note. We'll read it now. Quote, "After watching and listening to Donald Trump since he announced his candidacy for president, we have decided we won't report on Trump's campaign as part of the Huffington Post political coverage. Instead, we will cover his campaign as part of our entertainment section. Our reason is simple. Trump's campaign is a sideshow. We won't take the bait. If you're interested in what the Don has to say, you'll find it next to our stories on the Kardashians and the Bachelorette." End quote. So the Huffington Post effectively saying that they don't see Donald Trump as a credible candidate. They see him only as a celebrity. And of course, where would you cover celebrities? You cover them in the entertainment section. So Donald Trump's coverage will be right there. Now, of course, there are some more questions raised by this, because such as he is still running for president, and in the Huff poll, the Huff pollster average of polls, he's doing quite well. So, and he's been brought up as the subject of other attacks, and he's brought up a large debate across the country about illegal immigration. It's going to be a little odd if, as they say, there's a story on Kim Kardashian and The Bachelorette, then there's a story about Donald Trump's comments on legal immigration. There may be a little bit of an odd flow there, but Huffington Post says that Donald Trump coverage will now be found in entertainment rather than politics. They're kind of saying Donald Trump is not running a campaign that's like the other campaigns, not like a Jeb Bush campaign or a Marco Rubio campaign. He's running a campaign for himself. He's running a campaign as a celebrity for himself to kind of boost himself, so it's not worthy of our politics section. And of course, this was a issue that news organizations had to grapple with before Donald Trump announced a presidential run. This is really the first time we're seeing a place deal with it since he's announced a presidential run. But before he announced a presidential run, newsrooms had to question and figure out how they were going to cover Donald Trump, because in other campaign cycles, he would openly talk about how he might run for president. And of course, at first, you cover it because you think, hey, he might run. Then after a while, it becomes like them calling about the wolves. You realize, okay, he's not actually going to run. So after a while, newsrooms start to just not cover Donald Trump as much. If he said something noteworthy, okay, fine, you put on a headline or you throw an article on the website, but you don't do anything major about it, because the thing was, he's not going to run. What's the point in covering it? He's just doing it to boost himself. He's a celebrity with a TV show. This is bringing more attention to him, which is going to bring more ratings to his TV show. The only reason he's doing it is for himself, to increase his net worth, to increase his rating, to increase the ego. So that was the thinking most newsrooms had before he announced a presidential run. And of course, whenever he talked about running for president then, it was always kind of met with a good deal of skepticism by other political reporters who would always kind of add a caveat saying, well, he said that he might do this before, or along those lines. Kind of whenever Donald Trump said he might run, political reporters kind of throwing some water on that saying, we don't want to fall for this right away. However, then this time around, Donald Trump did run for president, or he did announce a presidential run. And so now, most news organizations have covered him as they have pretty much every other candidate, such as a Marco Rubio or a Jeb Bush. But of course, when it comes to media attention, he's gotten a large amount of, not really, at first it was not proportionate to his poll numbers, because when he first announced, he was still in the single digits. But what happened was with Donald Trump, he played well for television news, he played well for social media news, because Donald Trump tended, if you look at his announcement speech, It was him saying line after line that was just instantly became a soundbite you could easily replay. And for news television or television news producers, if you have a soundbite like that from a guy who's running for president, it's a fairly easy choice in most cases to run that on your program. And so you have a producer to do that on one program, and that happens on several programs on one network, and you have a few different networks, and of course you've got people tweeting it out, and you've got it on Facebook and all different social network platforms. Donald Trump was kind of everywhere. He got a lot of media attention. And then, as he got that media attention, his poll numbers started to come up, where now, nationally, he's either first or second, depending on which poll, but he's still right at the top. And then New Hampshire, he's in second place, and in Iowa, he's starting to rise. So now you're starting to see that he is one of the top candidates in the Republican Party. And of course, news organizations have covered him as every other candidate for the most part. But now you see the Huffington Post saying, no, we're not going to do this. Donald Trump, for his own, has responded, as you probably are not surprised if you take a look at his Twitter profile. He fairly frequently does kind of delve into media criticism, if you want to call it that, or just kind of saying, kind of giving credit to journalists he does like. And when a journalist says something he doesn't really like, he calls them out for it. But Donald Trump responded to the Huffington Post, although this time he actually did it on Facebook, not Twitter. And what he says is, he goes by and throughs, first he calls the Huffington Post unimportant, because he says, oh, this is written from the third person, we should point out. Mr. Trump is number one in the unimportant Huffington Post poll, along with all other recently released polls, including Reuters, Fox, USA Today, Suffolk University, and The Economist. Then it goes on to say how he's first place in Nevada, it claims, and it also claims he's first place among Hispanics. Then it says how he's doing well in New Hampshire, and it says he expects to win in Iowa and New Hampshire. Excuse me, I should have said he is number one in North Carolina, according to this release. And then it says about how Donald Trump has brought up the issue of legal immigration, and they claim start a national conversation, and then they call that one of the most important topics of the election cycle, end quote. Then it kind of goes on to tout Mr. Trump a little bit more, and then it starts to get back into the attacking the Huffington Post with this little bit. We'll quote this. If you read previously written tweets, Mr. Trump has never been a fan of Arianna Huffington or the money-losing Huffington Post. The only clown show in this scenario is the Huffington Post pretending to be a legitimate news source. Mr. Trump is not focused on being covered by a glorified blog. He's focused on making America great again, end quote. Donald Trump kind of coming back and saying, if you don't want to cover me as a credible person, I don't find you as a credible person. Really attacking the Huffington Post, and also offering up some red meat to the conservative base, because the Huffington Post is one of the most popular news websites in the country, but it is an openly liberal news source. The website has taken stances on issues such as same-sex marriage in the past. Arianna Huffington has talked about her politics, and the news website does have a liberal slant. So with this, Donald Trump kind of goes out and he attacks a liberal news website, which almost always works well for the conservative base, and can kind of talk about how they're not taking him seriously, and they're not focusing on the important issues like he is. So, of course, this for Donald Trump almost plays like a win-win for him getting to offer up some red meat, and then the Huffington Post kind of walking into this, then making the decision, they're standing by it, and Donald Trump is just going out and, well, attacking them for making that decision, and he gets to go out and kind of attack. Of course, in the journalism media circles, or Twitter, as these debates so often tend to happen, there is debate, as we said, about whether or not this is the right steps to take. Some have said and raised similar points to as Donald Trump, saying he is number one in some polls, doing very well, and he has brought up topics such as legal immigration, which we are starting to have a national conversation about, especially in light of violent activity by illegal immigrants. But you Donald Trump, or some have also said, maybe we shouldn't be covering Donald Trump as a legitimate candidate. There are some who are taking the Huffington Post side on this. So, but of course, the journalism world starting to have a much more public debate about this, and well, actually now just having a debate, including a public one, about whether or not and how to cover Donald Trump. Most news organizations covering him like they have every other candidate. But of course, now the Huffington Post saying they're not going to cover him as a candidate, they're going to cover him as a celebrity. We'll have to see what that looks like in the future, and especially when you start to see reporters, what kind of reporters we'll have to see get assigned to the Donald Trump beat. Will they have political reporters filing Donald Trump stories, or they're going to have the Huffington Post entertainment reporters at his campaign rallies? We'll have to take a look at that. And some quick other media news. The PBS NewsHour has gotten a new set. They've put out some photos. It's got a pretty clean look, focusing on kind of the big letters with the PBS. Moving on, we got pretty interesting media story, which has really evolved over the past 24 hours. So yesterday, just to rewind, Gawker published a story about the CFO of Condé Nast texting an escort. We're not going to name the gentleman involved, but the story was kind of based upon his also relation to a former Obama administration official being the C-suite level of a major media company, and also that he was texting a gay escort when he was a married man. Now, of course, you may start to be saying, what's the big deal there? And so you would think nothing kind of odd about this. This is a guy in a position of power who's doing something maybe not the best, maybe not the most moral upstanding. And of course, then when you start to read it, of course, before we even get to, there's the initial criticism that this was doing what's called gay shaming, and some criticism, not all of it, but some criticism has focused on how this article seems to blame the guy for texting a gay escort. That's part of it, but a majority of it has focused on other elements. If you read the article, which of course on Twitter some were kind of torn about saying, don't read this article, while also linking to an article or linking to the same article and talking about the article that they did not want to talk about, but that's Twitter regardless. If you go through and read it, you see that you start to see the source involved, because the Gawker reporter worked with the escort. You start to notice some things about the escort. Basically, that he kind of was not in moral upstanding either. He had a dispute, and he tried to kind of use his client to kind of pull the strings and help him out with his disagreement. The client, seeing what was going on and getting uncomfortable with how he was almost getting used, pulled out, but paid. Pulled out of this because he did not want to get involved with kind of like the power shuffle and anything like that. He saw the red flags, so he pulled out. Even though he pulled out, Gawker still kind of decided that this was newsworthy. Reporters pursued the story. They worked with the escort, had text messages. If it was kind of any other story, you would say it was well reported. Of course, the basis of the story is, and the foundation of the story, the newsworthiness of it, kind of shaky, but in terms of actually being done, it was well done. There's a firestorm over the story, as we said. People questioning it. Why would you write about this man? You've kind of just, many people saying, you've ruined his life, bringing in previously unknown gentlemen. So of course, Gawker has done similar things in the past. They're currently being sued by Hulk Hogan for publishing his sex tape. That trial is going to be starting soon in Florida. And of course, there, Gawker is claiming that he's talked about his sex life before. He's a public figure. They were in the right to clear it. None of that really applied to the gentleman involved here, but it was put out, and it was out there for several hours. People started to raise a storm. Gawker employees started to defend it a little bit, but then this afternoon, the article they announced would be deleted. Now, Nick Denton, who is the founder of Gawker, and laid out some of the same reasons before that I had said about why they felt comfortable laying out the Hulk Hogan, made the decision, or actually a senior management, or the top management, took a vote and decided to bring down the article. And Nick Denton, published a pretty lengthy blog post talking about the article, reviewing it, and apologizing, but not apologizing at the same time for its publication. So he says, the story involves extortion, illegality, and reckless behavior, sufficient justification, at least in tabloid news terms. The account was true and well reported. It contains or concerns a senior business It concerns a senior business executive of one of the most powerful media companies on the planet. In the early days of the internet, that would have been enough. Quote, we put truths on the internet, end quote. That has been the long-standing position of Gawker journalists, some of the most uncompromising and uncompromised on the planet. I cannot blame our editors and writers for pursuing that original mission. Then he goes on to say, not only is criticism of yesterday's piece from readers intense, but much of what they've said has resonated. Then he also says, some of our own writers, proud to work at one of the only independent media companies, are equally appalled. Then he says, I believe this public mood reflects a growing recognition that we all have secrets, and they're not all equally worthy of exposure. I can't defend yesterday's story as I can our coverage of Bill O'Reilly, Hillary Clinton, or Hulk Hogan. Him again mentioning Hulk Hogan by name, Hulk Hogan having that lawsuit. There was one tweet that was sent out and kind of went viral, where they took Nick Denton's own reasoning for why it was all right to publish Hulk Hogan, and then going through and saying, this doesn't apply in this scenario. So now him saying, you're right, our Hulk Hogan reasoning does not apply here. Then he kind of goes on to say about how Gawker, just like the rest of the internet, has kind of grown up, become more mature, and now they have to make more mature decisions, and not everything that would have flown or been all right 10 years ago is still all right. He says, every story is a judgment call. As we go forward, we will hew to our mission of reporting and publishing important stories that our competitors are too timid or self-consciously upright to pursue. There will always be stories that critics attack as inappropriate or unjustified, and we will no doubt again offend the sensibilities of some industries or interest groups. He lays all this out in saying that they shouldn't have published this. He goes through a pretty long piece saying we shouldn't have published this. But now we're starting to see there's a little bit of a public a revolt that is publicly occurring with Gawker over this piece. Because whereas Nick Denton kind of painted it as a story that everybody hated, he even says that writers disliked the piece, and pretty early on he says that there was more internal disagreements than usual over the piece. It seems not everyone was exactly against it. Some people were in favor of it. A reporter for Jezebel, which was a sister site of Gawker, said that they should go after C-suite employees. Her reason is, as a C-suite professional or as a CFO of a major media company, he is public enough for this to be relevant. And then this tweet came out, or the post came up on Politburo, from Gawker's, attributed to the Gawker Media editorial staff, and now they paint the decision to pull the post or to delete it, which is one of the rare times it's ever actually happened in Gawker history. They paint it as a editorial staff getting brought down by the business staff. And of course, there you start to see, and this is actually fairly common, the business side versus editorial. That's always gone around in journalism, the trying to make sure that the walls between the editorial staff are not, or there are walls between the editorial staff and the business staff. So that way, the business staff tries to get an advertiser. Editorial staff doesn't have to worry about not reporting on them. If they have an advertiser about the plumbing, local plumbing place, the editorial staff finds out the plumbing guy is using faulty clogs, they can feel free to report on that because that's newsworthy for that local newspaper. And because they're separate, they don't have to worry about, they, as the editorial staff, don't have to worry about kind of retribution. That is not their concerns because of that wall. So then the Gawker media editorial staff now paying this as a, hey, look, this is the business people trying to tamper down on our Free North Press and our journalism. And they also tie it back to the union because Gawker employees just recently unionized and they're one of the few online websites, online news journalism websites, to have a union. But they say, our union drive has expressed at every stage of the process that one of our core goals is to protect the editorial independence of Gawker media sites from the influence of business side concerns. Today's unprecedented breach of the firewall, in which business executives deleted an editorial post over the objections of the entire executive editorial staff, demonstrate exactly why we seek greater protection. Our unions on the post are not unanimous, but we are united in objecting to editorial decisions being made by a majority of non-editorial managers. Disagreements about editorial judgment are matters to be resolved by editorial employees. We condemn the takedown in the strongest possible terms. So then they're kind of painting it as a business versus editorial. And of course, bringing this internal fight out into the public, trying to kind of get some sympathy almost on their side as a business versus editorial, which is something we see with a lot of news websites, especially, although the way we tend to see it most is kind of with native advertising, which is a whole other topic. But that's where you start to see the business versus editorial. So now, of course, it'll be interesting to see where this Gawker story continues to evolve. You've had a number of both current and former Gawker employees coming out and giving their take on it, and also just kind of talking about what it means for Gawker and the internals of Gawker. Michael Wolff, the media analyst and media critic, has put out a piece, he basically ripped Gawker and their journalists, and so he is, as you can tell, not one of their fans at the moment, but he has kind of criticized Gawker for just the kind of the hatred and the hate spewing that their blog posts tend to be. Gawker articles tend to be very sarcastic. They can sometimes be witty, but also very sarcastic. And so some, like Michael Wolff, have said, this is what happens when you just allow them to keep being sarcastic and all like that, and you don't really enforce some kind of standard, then you have pieces like this. So we'll continue to see what happens with the editorial board, if there's, especially now that the union is starting to get involved in employees. And of course, this is starting to take on many different angles, but fascinating because at the very core, this was a man who tried to kind of keep a secret and try to get out of something so that way he wouldn't cause a stir or any kind of news. And now it's causing quite a stir and quite some news. Well, that wraps it up for today's Jungle Cast, or this week's Jungle Cast. Hope you all enjoyed it. We had a lot of interesting topics. It's been a fascinating news week. So make sure you send us your suggestions, your comments. You can follow us on Twitter, highly recommend it, at TKNNPOLJungle. You can follow the Political Journal on there. Get the latest media news, got all your kind of news. We've been really good about staying on top of the Gawker story, if you find that interesting, all other topics. And remember, TNN's got a few different accounts, so I'll go out there and follow them. Go on TKNN.info for the latest news every day. And of course, be sure to subscribe on iTunes for the podcast. That way you make sure you never miss an episode. But until then, for TKNN, I'm Tyler wishing you good news and a good night.